gutting the Voting Rights Act even more. We'll speak with Ari Berman of Mother Jones. Then as the rollout of Johnson & Johnson vaccines begin today, we look at the racial vaccination gap. Black Americans are not only twice as likely to die of COVID-19 as white Americans, but also dying at rates similar to those of white Americans who are 10 years older. We'll speak with Dr. Oni Blackstone about her call to lower the age cutoff for vaccine eligibility for Black Americans. Then, as the pandemic raged, abortion access nearly flickered out.
Abortion access was in crisis before the pandemic hit. And what we've seen over the past year is the collision of a deadly pandemic with many years worth of state laws aimed at making access to abortion as difficult as possible. And so the COVID pandemic, in many ways, has offered us a preview of what it will be like when the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade.
We'll speak to investigative journalist Amy Littlefield. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Governors around the United States have begun rolling back restrictions aimed at slowing the spread of COVID-19, even as the United States recorded another 58,000 new infections and 1,500 COVID-19 deaths Monday. Daily cases are down from January's record highs, but have plateaued at rates comparable with last summer's peak. The Centers for Disease Control Director, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, warned Monday steps to reopen public spaces may be coming too soon.
We cannot be resigned to 70,000 cases a day, 2,000 daily deaths.
Los Angeles County has begun vaccinating all school staff and is planning on reopening elementary schools and preschools by April 9th. Meanwhile, children in Chicago returned to in-person classes Monday for the first time in nearly a year. Former President Donald Trump and Melania Trump were secretly vaccinated against COVID-19 in January before leaving the White House. That's according to the New York Times, CNN, and other outlets who report the Trumps did not want to alienate supporters in the anti-vaccine movement by broadcasting images of their inoculations. About 1 in 5 U.S. residents over the age of 18 have been vaccinated, and the pace of inoculations is set to pick up with the first shots of Johnson & Johnson's single-dose COVID-19 vaccine due to be administered today. Also today, the Biden administration's announcing it secured a deal to have the pharmaceutical giant Merck produce shots of Johnson & Johnson's vaccine in a move that could sharply boost supply. The World Health Organization warned Monday the number of new coronavirus infections is rising worldwide for the first time in 7 weeks. In Peru, a second wave of COVID-19 cases and death has spawned shortages of bottled oxygen, leading to long lines and soaring prices for limited supplies. In West Africa, Ivory Coast and Ghana have begun administering shots of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine purchased under COVAX, the UN-backed initiative. Slovakia has become the second European Union country after Hungary to approve shots of Russia's Sputnik V vaccine. Slovakia has one of the worst COVID-19 death rates in the world. In Brussels, European Commission officials announced plans to issue certificates known as digital green passes to allow vaccinated people to travel more freely. United Nations is warning 400,000 Yemeni children under the age of 5 could die from acute malnutrition this year as the coronavirus pandemic and a Saudi-led war on Houthi rebels compounds the world's worst humanitarian crisis. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said Monday a donors' conference netted just $1.7 billion for humanitarian relief in Yemen, less than half the $3.8 billion needed to avert widespread famine.
Today, reducing aid is a death sentence for entire families. With the war raging, Yemen's children are paying the price.
The UN says about half of Yemen's population of 29 people is going hungry. Last month, President Biden pledged to end U.S. support for the Saudi-led war in Yemen, which began 6 years ago under President Obama. But the U.S. has refused to sanction Saudi Arabia's Minister of Defense, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, over the war in Yemen, and after he approved the assassination of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. State Department spokesperson Ned Price said Monday the administration is looking forward, not backward, on U.S.-Saudi relations.
We are very focused on future conduct, and that is part of why we have cast this, not as a rupture, but a recalibration.
President Biden is suffering major blowback for not sanctioning Mohammed bin Salman. The Senate has confirmed Miguel Cardona to become Secretary of Education. Cardona became Connecticut's youngest school principal at age 28. He's Puerto Rican and grew up in public housing. Meanwhile, the Senate Judiciary Committee voted 15-7 Monday to recommend Judge Merrick Garland be confirmed as Attorney General, setting up a vote by the full Senate. Senators are debating last-minute changes to a $1.9 trillion coronavirus stimulus bill approved by the House and are expected to begin debate as early as midweek. Democratic lawmakers have introduced a wealth tax on ultra-millionaires and billionaires to help fund President Biden's Build Back Better agenda. Co-sponsor Senator Elizabeth Warren said Monday the wealth tax would help reverse massive inequality that's only gotten worse during the pandemic.
We have watched the wealth of the billionaire class in America increase by more than $1 trillion over the last year. A 2-cent wealth tax would just help level the playing field a little bit.
The Department of Justice is appealing a ruling by a federal judge in Texas that puts millions of U.S. residents at risk of eviction. Last week, U.S. District Judge John Barker, a Trump appointee, ruled an order from the Centers for Disease Control temporarily ending evictions during the pandemic is unconstitutional. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau says more than 2 million people are more than 3 months behind on rent and could face eviction if and when the moratorium is lifted. President Biden has voiced support for Amazon workers in Alabama who are voting on whether to form a union. Biden posted this message to Twitter Sunday evening.
Unions lift up workers, both union and non-union, and especially black and brown workers. I've made it clear when I was running that my administration's policy would be to support unions organizing and the right to collectively bargain.
Some 6,000 Amazon workers in Alabama have until the end of the month to cast ballots in what could become the first successful union drive at a U.S. Amazon warehouse. Go to democracynow.org to see our interview with the Amazon workers. In immigration news, the Biden administration's giving asylum-seeking parents separated from their children by Trump the opportunity to decide if they want to reunite with their children on U.S. soil or in their country of origin. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, who's heading Biden's Family Reunification Task Force, said Monday the policy was, quote, the most powerful and heartbreaking example of the cruelty that preceded this administration, he said. Mayorkas said the government will explore legal pathways to allow parents who choose to return to the U.S. to be with their kids to remain in the country. While immigrant justice advocates celebrated the move, many have vowed to keep fighting until Biden abolishes the detention of all asylum-seeking families. Calls to boycott Goya Foods continue to grow after the company's CEO, Robert Inanue, falsely claimed Donald Trump had won the presidential election. Inanue gave an introductory speech for Trump Sunday at the Conservative Political Action Conference, or CPAC, in Florida.
My biggest honor today is going to be that I think we're going to be on the same stage as, in my opinion, the real, the legitimate, and the still actual President of the United States, Donald J. Trump.
In response, the president of the League of United Latin American Citizens, or LULAC, Domingo Garcia, told CNN, quote, when you put out lies to the community, there are consequences, and there are going to be ramifications for your product, he said. In northwestern Nigeria, officials say nearly 300 girls who were kidnapped from a boarding school in Zamfara state last week have been released and are now safe. Their release reportedly follows negotiations between government officials and the kidnappers. It's not known if the abductors received ransom payments. In France, a court in Paris has found former President Nicolas Sarkozy guilty of corruption charges, sentencing him to at least a year in prison for trying to bribe a judge in 2014. He's the second French president in the modern era to be convicted of a crime. Sarkozy will remain free as he appeals his case, a process that could take years. On Capitol Hill, Democratic lawmakers are beginning debate on two separate bills to protect voting rights. If enacted, H.R. 1, the For the People Act, and the John R. Lewis Voting Rights Act would bring some of the most sweeping changes to U.S. election law in generations. Meanwhile, the Georgia State House voted along party lines Monday to pass an overhaul of the state's election laws, requiring ID for absentee voting, curbing ballot drop boxes, and limiting weekend early voting hours. Georgia Democrats blasted the law as an effort to roll back civil rights. We'll have more on the story later in the broadcast. A warning to our audience. The story contains descriptions of sexual harassment. In New York, a third woman's accused Governor Andrew Cuomo of sexual harassment. Anna Ruck detailed her experience in an interview with the New York Times, saying she met Cuomo at her friend's wedding reception in 2019, where he reportedly grabbed her lower back, put his hands on her cheeks, and loudly asked if he could kiss her. She said, "I was so confused and shocked and embarrassed," Ruck told the New York Times. Her story was corroborated by a friend who witnessed the interaction, as well as photographs from the event. Governor Cuomo briefly addressed allegations made by two former aides in a statement Sunday night, saying his actions had been misinterpreted. On Monday, Democratic Congresswoman Kathleen Rice of New York tweeted, quote, "The time has come. The governor must resign." And in Australia, eight youth climate activists and a nun have filed a landmark class action lawsuit that could force the Australian federal government to stop approving new fossil fuel projects. The suit was filed in response to a proposal by a coal corporation to extend its mine in North New South Wales. 16-year-old climate justice advocate Anjali Sharma is the lead plaintiff in the suit.
This is a crisis that disproportionately affects people of colour, young people, and marginalised people around the world. So yes, I'm terrified. I'm terrified about hearing the Pacific Islands sink into the sea. I'm terrified about hearing the increasing prevalence of natural disasters like bushfires and droughts and floods.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org.
Welcome back to CKUT. It's time for a little weather. Wednesday brings scattered flurries and a high of minus 1 degree Celsius. Thursday will be sunny with a high of minus 6 degrees Celsius. Friday there will be scattered flurries and a high of minus 8 degrees Celsius. Saturday will be cloudy with sunny breaks and a high of minus 7 degrees Celsius. Sunday will be mainly sunny with a high of minus 7 degrees Celsius. Monday will be a mix of sun and clouds with a high of minus 3 degrees Celsius. And finally, Tuesday, there will be a mix of sun and clouds and a high of 2 degrees Celsius. Well, that wraps up the show. Keep listening to CKUT. We'll be right back.
Stars. This is a show about change and what's next. It's a show that asks questions and peels back the layers of our average everyday experience and goes beyond scratching the surface. We interview people doing incredible things who are making a difference around the globe. Join me as we listen in and get one step closer to understanding that big ideas shared create collaboration, collaboration can inspire community, and communities create social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
So my next conversation was a real treat for me for a whole lot of reasons. For one, it was about a brilliant, interesting, dynamic, and engaging new film called Fireball. And for me, more importantly, it was a conversation with Clive Oppenheimer and Werner Herzog to talk about this film. And we step into it in kind of an intriguing way. We do have some technical issues, so I hope you'll bear with us. We had a conversation from three different parts of the world coming together on Zoom. And thankfully, we were actually face to face. This is an Apple original. It is on Apple TV Plus now. You can sign up there and find out more about it. Search it or check out the link on the site. But Fireball is the film, and Visitors from Darker Worlds is the subtitle. We talk about mystery and wonder, and we get into volcanoes and about this, looking beyond this, below the surface, and understanding or a desire to understand things that we can't actually see. We talk about our origins and about the oldest thing in the universe, and about how Werner Herzog often, it seems, is flying into the unknown when he steps into a film, and how it's made. We get into a bit of a conversation around the existential and the spiritual implications, and that certainly comes out in the film. And we talk about, in my opinion, kind of an unlikely friendship, or maybe, as they both sort of discuss, a likely friendship between Herzog and Oppenheimer. And we talk about, Werner starts to get into, certainly in the film, but this notion of the fragility of our existence, and how these little micrometeorites, these little pieces of rock that are falling to the earth, these old pieces of rock, what are the implications? What does it mean for us as a culture? What does it mean for us as a globe? And what are the implications for humanity overall? It's as somebody in the film says, it's about curiosity. It's the currency of the cosmos, and what a beautiful thing that is. So it was a real treat for me to step into this interview. Check out the film. It's fascinating. Any of Herzog's films are well worth stepping into, and also Into the Inferno, which you could almost say, I don't know, can I call it part one? I hope you guys are okay with that. But also a brilliant film, and go back and look at Herzog's catalog if you haven't seen some of the, 70, 75 films that he's made over the years. He's starred in them, he's produced, he's directed, and you will recognize his voice. And I believe a deeply existential, philosophical filmmaker with, I don't know that you can watch a Herzog film and not be changed in some way. So join me as I step into this conversation with Clive Oppenheimer and Werner Herzog. And before you do that, though, don't forget davidpecklive.com for more information about my writing and my speaking. You can get a copy of Real Change is Incremental there. I would really love it if you found this interview on iTunes or Spotify. I would really appreciate it, or one of the other usual suspects. I would really appreciate it if you left us a review. It's hard to get them. And we are going to be having a contest very soon to drum up reviews and legitimate reviews, and also YouTube. Please subscribe to us. We have several hundred thousand views, but until we have over 1,000 subscribers, we aren't going to be making any revenue from that. So I'd really appreciate it if you do that as well. And then if you did find us through one of those paths, you know, G.K. Chesterton said, all roads lead to Rome. That's why so many people never get there. And perhaps that's part of the reason why it's so hard to find face to face. But if you landed on us through iTunes or Spotify, SoundCloud, whatever, one of the usual suspects, check out the website, facetofacelive.ca, for a whole host of other interviews, over 530 interviews there. We were at TIFF this year, Venice, Hot Docs. We've got lots of wonderful stuff coming up soon. Subscribe for the newsletter. You can advertise with us. We'd be happy to have that conversation. And once again, before I go, I'm going to reiterate, please leave us a review. We would so appreciate it. Like us on YouTube and subscribe there as well. But coming right up, don't touch that dial. We're going to be talking about Fireball Visitors from Darker Worlds with Werner Herzog and Clive Oppenheimer. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by two very special guests here with us today. And frankly, I actually can't believe I'm looking at the two of these folks face to face digitally, of course. We have Clive Oppenheimer here and Werner Herzog to talk about their new film, Fireball, Visitors from Darker Worlds. Thank you to you both for joining in.
Our pleasure.
So before we start, by the way, congratulations on the film. I was able to see it at the Toronto International Film Festival this year, and I've been reading reviews and reports. Love the film for so many reasons, for I guess probably just what I learned, what I took away from it, but also the deeper, or at least for me, the deeper existential places I went to as a result of it. But before we get into the film, I'd love to hear from you two about your friendship. You go, you know, Into the Darkness, I believe, Werner, you talk about how the two of you met on Mount Erebus and how Clive insisted that he turn his camera on the two of you and that you had a conversation. I'd love to hear about this unlikely friendship and the seeds as they were being planted. Could both of you step into that for a brief moment before we get into the film?
Well, I think real deep friendships are formed in childhood or adolescence. But grown-up men, as we both are, of course, can strike a friendship as well, not to the same depth. He struck me on Mount Erebus because he wore a tweed jacket up there at, I don't know, 35 degrees below zero or something like this. And we had a wonderful conversation, and you don't find a man like this on a volcano, active volcano in Antarctica, in the ice up there. And after I was done filming, he had a small camera, and he asked, can I do something for my camera? And he did. And so I think Clive has collected a lot of footage on his own, on other expeditions that he did in Africa and Indonesia and other countries. So he probably has a cornucopia of materials for at least two films that he should do himself.
Yeah, that's right. We met on this volcano in Antarctica at Mount Erebus. Werner was filming Encounters at the End of the World. And, you know, this is nearly 12,500 feet above sea level. It is minus 35, that's before you count the wind chill. And this is where I encountered Werner for the first time. And no one like Werner had ever shown up in our little remote field camp perched on the side of this active volcano. Among other things, we had a nightly DVD screening with director's commentary. You know, it was really, really extraordinary. And I was captivated by Werner's storytelling, and the reason I had a camera to point at him was that I had just started a collaboration with an Italian photographer and artist who had a commission to make a video installation on volcanoes. And so this is why I had a camera and I was filming anything that interested me. It proved, this is 2006, it proved to be, I think, a real juncture in my life, sort of carrying on doing the science, but also going off off in a different direction with our collaboration and our friendship.
I think the real question, though, Clive, is why were you wearing tweed? I think that's an important question to answer.
Well, Clive denies it was tweed. It was something else, but to me it looked like tweed, like the early Himalaya climbers in 1915 or 1920 who tried to reach the summit of Mount Everest. They came in tweed jackets.
Well, I'm sure that the clan of the Harris tweed would object if they
yeah. Clive is certainly correct. Yeah.
Well, Clive, there's no denying though that you were looking quite stylish in that shot. That's for sure.
It's
no unusual, not stylish. Unusual. You do not find where everybody wears thick down jackets and some sort of double layered boots. You are not even allowed to wear your own boots. They would be issued to you because if you bring your best boots, your warmest boots, you still would freeze your toes away. You would freeze your whole foot off. So so you get standard issue high quality gear that the Antarctic commissions or whatever would issue to you.
Do you think there's I've traveled a fair bit over the years, and I wonder, is there a vulnerability when you're standing on the edge of this volcano, as you said, Clive, 12,500 feet. I think it sort of, I don't know what volcanoes do. It burped. It sent off an emission. There was steam coming up, and you were both so casual about it. But are we a little more vulnerable when we're kind of at risk like that? I mean, it's what a beautiful sort of start of the seeds that were planted there to me. Just what a beautiful place to start a friendship.
It was, and I often reflect on the serendipity that we both had these paths that intersected on a remote volcano in Antarctica. I mean, for me, it was running into a geochemist called Phil Kyle. I met him in Kamchatka, of all places, and he worked in the Northern Hemisphere summer in Kamchatka, and in the Southern Hemisphere summer, he was down in Antarctica, and he invited me to join him on his field program on Erebus, and that's where I met Werner, who knew a gentleman called Henry Kaiser, who shot some wonderful footage in the Ross Sea off Ross Island, where Erebus volcano is, and intrigued by that footage, that's I think what led Werner there. So we had these parallel paths that brought us to that encounter on the volcano.
And of course, you trust each other when it comes to unusual situations. We were filming in Indonesia, a volcano, and we were quite close, and the volcano had become quite active. And we were on a very narrow road, and Clive said, you have to turn the car around first, and you can't turn it around because the road was not much wider than the car was wide, and ditches on either side and rice paddies. So we went a mile or so until we could turn around so that that we were looking for an exit with the car, and Clive insisted, and we did so. And we actually started to film the volcano, and Clive said, it does not look good, let's get out of here now. And we just filmed how it erupted.
Wow.
And we tossed the camera into the car, jumped into the car and fled. And it's not cowardice, it's normal human behavior and responsible behavior, because we had a small film crew, a cinematographer, a sound man. You just do that. And we got away with some very intense footage. And 7 days later, when we were already somewhere else, the volcano erupted again, and villagers who lived there for generations were unsuspecting and caught, and I think 11 of them or 7 of them died. So exactly at the spot where we had been filming, where Clive and I were on a volcano in Vanuatu archipelago. And both Clive and I wore these kind of suits. It looks like astronauts a little bit, this silver colored suits and asbestos or whatever suits. And we went very, very, very close to where the masses came shooting up. And we filmed there, and you stand there, and you know it can hit you. Hmm. Time. So we did it for the sake of the film. And then we returned quickly. That was that. But you do such a thing not with an idiot next to you. although no, neither he, the expert, nor I, the amateur, could predict whether there would be a big burp and that would have finished us.
Yeah, I was certainly not keen to, be responsible for Werner's unfinished movie. So
right.
I was keeping an eye out. But that's the first time I think Werner's ever publicly acknowledged that it's us in the silver suits heading down. This has been a mystery until now.
Oh, is that right?
Right here. And I'm often asked as a volcanologist, well, you must put those silver suits on. That's the only time I've ever done it. And it was for cinematic purposes.
Wow.
Not for pure research. But another comment on the volcano in Sumatra, Sinabung, that Werner was describing. We were fully authorized to go into the exclusion zone. And we drove in, and the village is abandoned. Everything is covered in ash, and the vegetation is just overgrowing all the dwellings. And as we drove in, I noticed some washing hanging out on a line, not without any ash on it. This clearly just been hung to dry. And it immediately keyed me into the fact that although we're in supposedly an exclusion zone, of course, when people are faced with a volcano that rumbles for months and years, and their homes are intact, well, they go back to tend their gardens and their animals. So this was quite revealing to me of one of the complications of protecting populations threatened by volcanoes. People don't always accept evacuation orders.
Yeah, and you're actually speaking to a man who, with local measurements, was it Mount Merapi, very densely populated around the volcano, sounded the alarm. And of course, a system of spreading the alarm was installed already. And because Clive insisted, get out of here now, hundreds of thousands of people fled. And only 400 perished in the eruption that ensued. Was it 400 or that died at the time?
Yes, about 400, but I must say it wasn't my call. We made some gas monitoring equipment that was used.
Yes, it was his system and his methodology that he invented.
The early warning system, as it were.
Yes, and Clive also has sounded alarms whenever he was physically present, but he established a system of detection and then, of course, a functioning warning system. Of course, the local authorities have to do that, but the advice and the installation of it has saved maybe 100,000 people.
Well, you know, so much to talk about. We're so not going to have enough time to cover the ground. I've made copious notes about the film. Clive, Werner, what is it about the unknown? I think that maybe has brought you two together as a scientist, as an artist, as a poet, as a filmmaker, and a storyteller. You know, I think I read somewhere, Werner, that you said you knew nothing about going into when you flew into the Antarctica. You know, you were flying into the unknown. It seems to me that that's a very much a theme for you in your films. And isn't that what a scientist steps into, Clive? And maybe, Clive, you could start there. I mean, I'm trained academically in philosophy. All philosophy begins in wonder. Is that where you start, Clive? Is it wonder? Is it mystery? Is it magic?
Yeah. Clive.
Yes, it is. It's curiosity. And I think it's also a kind of a obsession as well, which is combined with it, because you need to be very dogged. In my case, it's making observations. So, you know, I am on the side of the volcano pointing spectrometers at it and measuring its heat and gas emissions. So you get, very, very focused on doing that. getting the best data you can under challenging circumstances. And then that's really the tip of the iceberg. Then you have a lot of data that you need to plot in every combination possible and see what emerges from it. And then you're still not done. Then you've got to figure out what the patterns you find mean. So it is curiosity that drives you to do what is a lot of poring over spreadsheets and thinking. And it's for me, with volcanology, a lot of it is because we're trying to reveal what you can't see. We're trying to understand things that are going on beneath our feet. The real guts of a volcano, the magma reservoirs and the conduit that brings the molten rock up to the surface. And there's so many questions. Why does a volcano erupt in a particular way? But I think the way that this intersects for me with Werner's world is that the science is only part of it, particularly if you are using volcanology to protect populations. Then the science only gets you so far. You have to understand people's belief systems, how communities react, how they perceive threats, how they react if you do sound the warning. And so I guess through that and through being based in a geography department where I rub shoulders with colleagues who work in the humanities and the social sciences, I've just become very fascinated by the entanglements between nature and culture. Mm. And that's what's at the heart of these films that we've made.
I would say, of course, curiosity is always in me, the filmmaker, but there's something else I would qualify it slightly differently. It's a sense of awe. If you don't have the sense of awe, you shouldn't be a scientist.
A sense of awe leading to more questions, Werner. Is that it? Is that what turned the lens for you guys from the ground to the sky with respect to Fireball and the future, as it were?
The predictions. He was a loser.
He overstretched himself eventually. Yeah. The stone in the 19th century, it was baptized. So its meaning has lived ever since. Its journey in some ways, 4.5 billion years in space, its journey only just began when it struck this field outside Ensisheim. But I think the meaning of meteorites, it's so multidimensional. They speak to our origins, both the idea that prebiotic molecules were and are delivered by meteorites and comets around the universe. These extraordinary 100 carbon chained organic molecules.
Yeah, sugar, yes.
Amino acids, the real basic building blocks for life. And they speak to our human origins when we think about the huge impact at Chicxulub in the Yucatan 65 million years ago that kind of reset the biological clock on Earth and gave rise to the mammals. And they speak to our destiny as well when we look at the Planetary Defense Coordination Office at NASA headquarters that's looking out for near-Earth objects that might come a bit too close in the future.
Would you guys say, would either of you say that this film Fireball is a bit of a warning? A warning might be strong, but a reminder to, yes, to look up, to look down, to look around, but to really be present? Is that a fair takeaway from Fireball?
I think one takeaway for me is the nocturnal.
Mm.
And how for so many of us living in urban environments, we... our night is now colonized by artificial light. And so we, many of us have lost that sense of awe and wonder of the cosmos. We don't see more than a dozen stars at night. We certainly, don't see the Milky Way. And so for me, that's part of it. It's not so much a warning, but a little bit of nostalgia for me.
Werner, you included a shot in the film of a scientist, I think, finding a piece of rock. I don't know if that would have been called a micrometeorite. Maybe you can tell us about that, Clive. But he's reduced to tears. And I'm so glad you included that. For me, that was, you know, that was an important point. I will reflect on that. I will refer back to that moment.
A Korean scientist, and it was footage that the Koreans shot themselves 3 or 4 years before before we were filming. Clive discovered this footage when he was in Korea, and he can tell you about his Korean experience. And we immediately said, that's the man we have to meet, and we have to get permission to include this footage, because he screams in joy, and then everything happens as it should not happen in movie making. All of a sudden, a sidekick character comes ass forward, crawling towards the lens. I mean, it's so no motivation, rear end in front, and wrong timing, and yet it's a wonderful piece of movie. So it was obvious we have to get more footage with these Koreans. And of course, Clive met them out in the blue ice, and he knew the Korean scientists from way before.
Yeah, the movie, The Inception, in a way, it came from a visit to the Koreans Polar Research Institute in South Korea, just 3 years ago. And they gave me a tour of the labs, including a stop by the meteorites labs. And I was immediately struck just visually that all the meteorites were in an ultra clean lab. And we're looking from the outside through a glass window, and then each meteorite is in a cubicle with a nitrogen atmosphere. And so I was very struck by the kind of visual aesthetics of this curation, but also talking with the meteoriticist, I'm a geoscientist, so I know a little bit about meteorites, but I never really thought much about them. You know, they're 4.5 billion years old. It's the oldest thing that you can ever touch. And this kind of scientific veneration also, it put me in mind of the black stone, one of the holiest relics of Islam, set in the wall of the Kaaba, the Grand Mosque. And so this is really what gave the idea to make a movie on this. And the Koreans very kindly invited us to join them on the annual meteorite hunt. They found 1,000 already. The Americans have found thousands and thousands more, and the Japanese and the British and so on. They go out every austral summer, and you know, this was immediately a question for me. You've got thousands and thousands. Why do you need more? right. And it's because they just want to find something they've never found, some exotic meteorite. I asked one of the meteoriticists with us in Antarctica, you know, what would you really get excited about? And he said, well, imagine if we found a sedimentary rock from Mars, and what it might tell us about past environments, or whether, you know, the presence of water and so on. So that's what they're out there for.
Is Fireball, and sadly, we need to wrap up in a couple of minutes, but is this more about the future? And this question is for both of you, but Werner, I mean, you to me strike me as a profound existentialist on so many levels. Is this about stepping into our future, or is this more for you about reflecting about our past, or is it more than that?
No, I think we are describing our present status of things, and we are describing, in a way, the fragility of our existence. And I mean not only our individual, but our collective existence. And of course, there are lots of things that could finish us off easily. For example, a strong solar flare could have catastrophic consequences that would wipe out the electrical grid and the internet, and that would be the end of us. Only a few pockets of hunter-gatherers would survive. Microbes, of course, are always after us. We can see it right now. Mm-hmm. Human stupidities could do it, like destroying our environment, or a nuclear holocaust is still around the corner. If we want to destroy each other, we can do it easily. So there's a certain fragility, and we never can sit back and think everything is going to go on like this for millennia. It won't. It simply won't.
I think that's true. Certainly, that, you know, super volcanoes and large bolide impacts certainly throw a certain light on human stupidity.
So, and maybe that's the perfect place to end it. But I do want to ask one last thing. This notion of discovery, I love the fact that is this a trilogy of films you guys have sort of done together now. I'm interested in what might be next. But isn't it marvelous what has come out of a relationship, you know, that was, the seeds were planted at the top of a volcano, and here we are having a conversation about the fragility of life. Isn't that a beautiful thing?
I thank my lucky stars.
Well, we don't know, only future will show. I mean, Clive could be, in the long range, because he's much younger than I am, he could be the anchor man for a whole series of scientific films, like, let's say, the BBC and David Attenborough, but much better than that.
It's a nice shout out, Clive.
No, let's give David Attenborough credit. He's a wonderful presence on screen. I might disappear for a while in doing some feature films. We might join for a third piece for a trilogy. We don't know.
Well, listen, it's been a real pleasure chatting with you. You both, I feel like we've barely got out of the gate. This is a film that, I mean, I love this film. This is a film worth seeing more than once. For those of you out there, we're going to do our best to get word out on the street. Thank you for your time today and joining me on Face to Face. It's been a real pleasure. Clive Oppenheimer, Werner Herzog here today talking about their new film, Fireball. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Today. At least I could give you a goodbye chance. At least I could give you a goodbye chance. Make sure my levels are at around 8.
CKUT 90.3 FM.
Blah, blah, blah.
It's kind of a tongue twister.
Am I popping my peas?
CKUT 90.3 FM.
Start again.
Oh, should I do that? Okay.
I need a script.
CKUT 90.3 FM.
So, you want me to go through it again and actually say that?
This sounds so repetitive.
See, now I can't do it. Once more.
CKUT 90.3 FM.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Wait, wait, do you want me to say hello?
I'll have to do another one.
Yeah, maybe one last one.
Radio CKUT 90.3 FM.
Are you recording? You are? Oh. Can you press stop?
This message is intended for all Quebecers. We must take extreme measures to curb the pandemic. Only essential services remain open. Gatherings are prohibited. It's forbidden to leave your home between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. These efforts aim to protect our healthcare workers, seniors, and loved ones. Let's comply with the lockdown and curfew to lower the risk of contracting COVID-19, because our health is important. For more information, visit quebec.ca/confinement. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
You're listening to